Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. To find out more about membership and how you can join the community and carry on the conversation, visit www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu. But we will get going with today's episode, where I'm going to start by letting you know that we unfortunately had some slight audio issues when recording this episode. The issues were on my end, which means when I'm talking, it might sound slightly crackly throughout the episode and slash or skip at times, which I apologize for in advance. Luckily, our guest's audio was completely fine. And on that note, the amazing guest we have on today's show is one Carrie Kish. Carrie is an avid herpetologist and animal trainer with a 15-year career in professional dog training, working primarily with dangerous dogs and dogs with fear and anxiety disorders. In 2012, while working for San Diego Zoo Global, Carrie co-founded Reptelligence with her co-worker and good friend Alex Kinold, with the intention of exploring and showcasing the cognition abilities of reptiles and amphibians. Since that time, the Facebook page Reptelligence, Enrichment, Training and Education has gained an international following, including pet owners, veterinarians, zoo curators, professional animal keepers and trainers of all species. Carrie has worked closely with a variety of species from rhinos to roaches, parrots to porcupines, cheetahs to kestrels and tuataras to tarantulas. She holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from Biola University and is working towards a Master's degree in Ethology at the Ethology Institute, University of Cambridge. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Carrie Kish to the show today. Carrie, how are you?
I am great. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you for having me. I feel quite privileged to be speaking to you. I love your project that you've started and all of the wonderful discussion that has been facilitated through it.
Thank you very much, Carrie, and it's an honor to have you. Thank you for taking time out of your day, and I've been wanting, this will be episode, 51, 52, I think 53. If I'm correct. And I've been wanting to do a reptile episode for 53 episodes.
So. Oh, wow. That's amazing. I'm so happy that you have an interest in this.
Yeah, well, as I said, I'm on full conviction we've found the right person for the job. So very excited about the conversation that's about to follow.
I'm so excited. And I am a behavior nerd. And so it's exciting to spend time talking to another behavior nerd, if it's okay if I call you that. About reptiles and all the amazing things happening with their training and enrichment.
I'm self-identified behavior nerd, so that's completely fine. We're going to dive straight into the first question, Carrie. Can you please build on your introduction that we just gave there and share more about what you currently do, Reptelligence, and your view of the importance of training and enriching reptiles and also educating others about it?
Yeah, certainly. Reptelligence actually started, I guess this is now 5 or 6 years ago, and it was just me and my friend, and we were sitting around saying, gosh, there's no resource for zookeepers. There are these different studies going on within the science community. There's some citizen science but wouldn't it be great if we could bring it all together in one place? And so we sat there and we made this Facebook page and we watched the numbers go up, you know, 10 people, oh, yay, 20 people, yay, there's 20 people that care about reptile training. This is amazing. And now it's sort of grown to something larger than I think either of us could have imagined. But at Reptelligence, we have a small number of reptiles from different taxa that we are working on training and enrichment with. So finding ways to give choice and control to these animals and then making that information readily available to other both hobbyists, veterinarians, zookeepers, and encouraging also a conversation among other keepers and hobbyists so that it's just a free sharing of information to sort of push forward this. I guess it's a bit controversial of the status quo that, you know, reptiles maybe need more than what they're getting, and how can we advance that? And then, so in addition to the work done with the physical animals at Reptelligence, we also do a lot of education and discussion and are available for questions for those that are training animals or even have questions just about basic husbandry to get to the point of being able to provide more enrichment and training.
Yeah, well, we're definitely grateful for the inspiration that you and Alex originally had to get this started. So on behalf of Planet Earth, thank you. And we will link to the Reptelligence Facebook page. Is that the best area to link to from the podcast write-up?
It is right now, and it does actually have a website link that will forward to the page. But currently there is not a formal website set up for the Reptelligence project, but that may be coming in the future. And I'll give you that link as well.
Everyone's on Facebook, and so that's a pretty smart place to be hanging out, I think. I like that you use some words in there, choice and control. That's something we talk about a lot on this podcast. And the other word that you chose to use in there was controversial. So how does what we're doing now, why Reptelligence and the great stuff you're doing, how does that compare to, am I okay to label it traditional way of management?
I mean, I think that we, those of us that are very involved in behavior and where behavior modification and training and studying and research is going in the future, try to stay away from labels in general. But I think as far as maybe how most people would view it, I think traditional is a fine word. So there are certain, I think I would say, not to steal Susan Friedman's word, but I think cultural fog is a great word to describe. Maybe sometimes we see things in reptiles, even as traditional keepers who manage reptiles, and we interpret it differently because we've sort of been told to interpret it differently. So maybe we see a reptile make a choice or invite a social contact or interact with an enrichment device in a way that we didn't expect, and we almost want to discount it because it's a reptile and it can't do that. And I think that that puts us at a disadvantage as a reptile keepers, because I think maybe we're missing some of what the most amazing things about reptiles are. And I think some of the traditional management has moved towards keeping these animals in smaller spaces with less and less, I guess as a keeper, I would call it furniture, plants and different spaces within their habitat. And so I think the more we minimize, and I would almost call it deprivation, the more that we create a deprived environment for reptiles, the less behavior we see, which in turn sort of reinforces this idea that the status quo, that reptiles don't have behavior, that they are merely reactive, that they don't have premeditated thinking, that they don't make choices and whatnot. And so obviously coming in and saying, yes, they do show preferences. Yes, they can be trained. Yes, they can make choices. Yes, that choice and control is important. Yes, the ability to display a full array of their natural behavior in human care is important. I think it does kind of butt heads a bit with traditional management.
So it's really, from what I'm taking away from what you're saying, us changing how we see things. And it reminds me of something I heard about a 100-meter sprint and a record for that. And at a time in history, people were saying, oh, you can't do the 100-meter sprint in X amount of minutes. And then someone did it, and then suddenly everyone was doing it. Is that a good analogy for what's happening in reptile training? People are saying, well, it's not important.
Yeah, and, you know, a follower of the page told me actually just recently, and I thought it was an interesting analogy. She's been an animal trainer for almost 4 decades, and she said, I remember when dolphins were just dumb fish. And she's sort of aligning that to where reptile training and enrichment is going, and that, you know, our perceptions so much sort of alter what we're seeing. And once that those perceptions are sort of changed, we see things in a different way. So I think that analogy you've used as well is quite perfect. And sort of by default, I think reptiligence has become a place where invert keepers are coming as well and saying, where can I talk about spiders, or where can I talk about mantids? And we've just sort of enveloped all of that, even though I still have quite a bit of learning to do myself on invertebrates.
So you talk about how reptiligence has got many different goals. One of them is to share this information with the wider community. You're also quite passionate, and correct me if I'm wrong, about sharing this information with people who visit zoos and wildlife parks and showing them that reptiles can and do learn and engage in their environment more. Can you speak to the importance of this?
Absolutely. And one of the big motivations in starting reptiligence actually started with how zoo visitors see reptiles in zoos. And within zoos, there is a bit of a political structure that you have to get through to change husbandry, to change enrichment. And by having a resource where keepers can go and say, hey, look, this organization is doing this, can we try it too? I feel like that makes that change a little bit easier, because you're not simply saying, let me try this, I don't know if anyone ever has before. But the main motivation is I actually started with habitat design, and I was doing a lot of restructuring habitats such that the animals would utilize the entire habitat. And when they were moving around or when they were interacting with enrichment, I saw that zoo visitors were much more likely to stand there and to watch the animal for longer and to interact with the keepers and ask questions and be so much more interested in what the animals were doing. And so I really wanted to take this outside the habitat. So being in education for most of my zoo career, I've worked largely with animal ambassadors, animals that come out up close to people. And one of the things that really sort of sparked it and took it off is when I started with the reptile show with the wonderful Kate Silvera at the Living Desert. And they were doing so many wonderful things to showcase reptile behavior. And the show just continued to grow and grow and grow until there was, you know, standing room only for a reptile show, which is quite exciting because these animals were not simply being held in hand and talked about. They were doing behaviors, and that behavior was being discussed. And from that, we realized, well, the snakes need some training as well. And so it would be, you know, the lizard comes out and he's targeting and doing these wonderful stand-up behaviors. And then the tortoise comes out and he's showcasing choice and control, moving across the stage. And then we had, you know, the snake in our hands, and we're talking about the snake. And you could noticeably see a difference in the audience. And so when we took that snake and put it on a branch so it could move freely back and forth across the branch, and then finally built a structure that the snake could move around, like a tree-like structure, so that people could see the snake moving. There was a change in how the audience looked at that animal, and there was a change in how they interacted with that animal after the show. So when we're doing touching after, when you have the snake simply in your hands, I noticed that people were more likely to be more rough with the animal. But if they're on the tree and you're telling them, this animal has a choice of whether he wants to stay and interact. If he goes up high, then we're done touching. And if he goes into his crate, he's saying that he's well done, and how we're interacting with him. If we're gentle, if we are kind with him, if, you know, we're touching one at a time and we're gentle, he'd be more likely to stay here for a longer amount of time. And I saw that that really resonated with visitors, and they started to see the animal not as an object, but as a living being, that their behavior had a consequence on how the animal behaved. And it was just a beautiful thing to see. And it's just further motivated me to continue with this project and be able to show that with all of these different types of reptiles.
I look forward to listening back to this conversation in 10 years' time and seeing where everyone's at, because what you've described is absolutely fantastic and excites me. And also, I've seen a picture of that structure somewhere. Is it on the Reptelligence page for people to go look at?
I don't know if it is on the Reptelligence page. It's certainly on different zookeeper pages. I've had different keepers visit the show, and they tend to post some pictures of it. I could certainly send you some pictures, and we could see about getting some up on the page as well. It's out there for sure.
Yeah, if we could maybe get one or two and put in the write-up even for people to go see what this tree looks like.
Certainly. That'd
be really cool. Hey, thank you so much for sharing, Carrie. Moving forward, we've talked about all of these ideas, and we always like to back up ideas with science. And there has been significant research done here, hasn't there? Can you talk about some of the research that you're aware of that's been done with learning and training in snakes and other ectotherms?
Yeah, there is actually I would say it's a bit hard to find. So which we noticed also when we were first starting Reptelligence, you sort of have to be committed to looking for it, but there are some actual published studies out there. I think a couple of the ones that I enjoyed the most are, there's pros and cons to these studies, of course, because they're in sort of a science environment, right? So we're keeping the animals a bit of a sterile, deprived environment in order to get these results, which I have a bit of an ethical conflict with. But there is an indigo study, which is with the eastern indigo snake, which is one of my favorite snakes. And they were trained through negative reinforcement. So they were shaped with water. They were given water as a reward for doing this behavior. And they were shaped from touching a string to touching a button. And touching the button, they were then able to obtain water. So this was a multiple sessions. So it shows that they had memory as they went through these sessions. Showed that operant conditioning was possible. Showed that water could be used as a reinforcer. Well, another thing it showed, which I guess we can take it for however we like, but the snakes were willing to perform this behavior even if it did not yield a reinforcer every single time. So I think one of the things that needs more data and study is, you know, how long can snakes keep these memories? Do they stay with them, or do they have more of a short-term memory? And I think this study shows that they can sort of keep this memory a longer time. There is a corn snake study which is quite old. It's probably one of the beginning studies where we were actually studying snakes in an ecologically significant way versus kind of trying to subject them to the same studies that we would do with mammals, where they put corn snakes in a very large open space, which most snakes, especially if they have not been trained to be comfortable with that or habituated, will then immediately seek shelter. So they put them in this big open space and then shined a bright light on them. So they would then seek shelter, and they changed which holes led to shelter and which were simply sort of blank holes. And they put signals, visual signals, above the ones that actually led to shelter. And they showed that the snakes could actually learn which ones were the exits faster and faster. They went from 700 seconds to just 30 seconds. So that's quite a bit more than we could say is simply a statistical anomaly. It seems to show that there was actually training involved there. And another one that I enjoy is there was some scent training with garter snakes, and they trained them to make choices as far as which way that they would go in a device, if they were going to go to one side or the other. And then once they had trained them to go to the scent. So they started with, I think, a lemon scent. They then trained them to avoid the lemon scent and go to the other side, and they saw similar data with each. So they were not simply displaying a preference for the smell. They were just displaying actual training in that regard, and that seems to indicate an ability for operant conditioning as well. And then I think the most recent is probably the with the wild Burmese python, where they were trained to press a button to obtain food. Again, there was a little bit of deprivation in this, in that they were offered very small food rewards, but they were able to be trained through operant conditioning to do so. So, I mean, that's not an insignificant amount of published studies, and I would dare to say that there's probably more out there. But again, it's not the easiest to find. You just type in, you know, snake cognition, it takes a bit of time to sort of sort through everything and find what's out there.
And so just with the, we'll go back to the start, the indigo snakes, you mentioned that it was trained via negative reinforcement. So what you're talking about there is the snakes were deprived of water, so they were drinking to remove thirst. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And yes, that's what they were doing. I have heard from a couple of hobbyists that they are using water, droplets of water, as a positive reinforcer to sort of build their trust bank with their snakes. So I don't want to discount water as a reinforcer, but in that case, there was some deprivation to improve the motivation to seek the water. And just some natural history, indigo snakes do tend to prefer high humidity, and they do drink water daily. So I think probably they were chosen in somewhat capacity for this study for that reason.
Cool. And the corn snakes chose color discrimination, or demonstrated color discrimination. So the next step is match the sample training with corn snakes.
Yeah, I think corn snakes are quite a good candidate for studying, because they are active during the day, and they are a faster metabolism snake, so they process food quickly. And I mean, obviously we have a lot to learn about their cognitive abilities as well, and how far those go.
And then the garter snakes, so they were reinforced for going to the trained smell, or in a direction of that, and then reinforced with food, was it? Or how did that work?
Yeah, they were reinforced with food. What's interesting is in that particular study, they were really trying to separate the olfactory system. So they were trying to particularly not allow the snake to touch the item that they were smelling with their tongue. So they wanted to sort of see how far they could go with just a smell, and a smell that was not a food-related item. So in the first set of studies, they used lemon, and in the second set of studies, they used a chemical that smells a bit like banana and apples. So definitely not items that these carnivorous snakes or insectivorous snakes or even fish-eating snakes would go after. So it was a novel scent, and they would situate it such that they would have to rely on a different part of their olfactory system.
Yeah, super interesting. And I always have this thought, I think about these types of studies and what we take away from them. And the thought is that it's really cool, really amazing. And at the same time, it's kind of like if they didn't have this ability to learn, they would have gone extinct a long time ago. So it's also kind of proving common sense to some degree in my potentially rational or irrational mind of Ryan Cartlidge.
Yeah, of course there is that. I mean, everything on earth is made to behave, and so if an animal doesn't have behavior, of course it's not going to survive. So but again, coming up against what the status quo is now, and what sort of these static preconceptions are, and how highly we hold to them, you sort of have to have this research to be able to show, to kind of get through all of that fogginess. But I think we're getting there.
Yeah, and the work you're doing is definitely helping to lift that fog. That was a lot of fun to learn about, Carrie. For our next question, firstly, I want to congratulate you on your recent trip to Sweden to present at the Choice Control and Communication Conference. That's really exciting, because you went over there to present on snake training, didn't you?
I did, and I have to thank the wonderful Eva Bartleton for that opportunity. It was quite amazing, and the amount of feedback and encouragement I have received from presenting there, it's just unfathomable, and I can't even probably express it well in words, but it was a wonderful, wonderful experience to meet up with so many other people that are excited about this training. And not even I didn't even present it in the sense of training all ectotherms, although these principles certainly apply to all, but training snakes in particular, to see people so excited about learning how to train snakes was just, I can't even express how amazing that was.
Yeah, I can imagine. And we have Eva to thank for this podcast as well. She put me and you in contact. And I've had the pleasure of looking over the presentation that you gave, because you sent it through to me. So thank you very much for that. And I feel like we could do numerous podcast episodes just on that presentation. But I picked something out which I thought would resonate with the listeners of this podcast, and I thought would be a good discussion point. And in that presentation, you gave four steps to training a snake. Can you run us through these four steps?
I can. And they're a bit loopy in the sense that one kind of leads to the other. And also I would preface it with, I don't think this just applies to snakes. But the first step would be taking data on the animal itself. So I think sometimes we get sort of super excited and I'm going to start this training program. But really the first important thing to do is observe the animal. How do they use their space? How do they react to you coming into or being around their space? Are they using their whole space? Or can we make some adjustments to make sure that, first of all, we're getting behavior within the habitat where they're comfortable before we're inviting them out? Is the animal healthy? Do they, you know, eat, shed, and eliminate on a normal schedule? Is there anything we need to address in that regard? And is the space appropriate for the species? I think sometimes I get approached about aggressive behavior in reptiles or different ectotherms, and sometimes it's a husbandry issue where the animal doesn't feel comfortable. And then, of course, if they're housed with other animals, you have to sort of take that into account. And how are you going to sort of separate them out for the training? And then within that data as well, you're going to see kind of how the animal displays their stress. And so with one animal in particular, a Dumeril's boa, when I first started working with her, we would give her boxes for enrichment. And we thought that it was quite lovely how she loved these boxes and she would sort of squeeze herself tightly into them. She would move in and out of them. But we realized when we gave her sort of a couple weeks off of being handled or being used for education, we would give her all these different boxes and she could care less about the boxes. So it wasn't that the box was reinforcing, it was that it was a way that she was showing that she was actually not comfortable. It was her way of seeking comfort. And so from being able to take that data, we were able to see, well, when she's squeezing tightly into her hide and there's not a good reason for it, it's not seasonal, she's not in a shed cycle, well, that means that maybe she needs a day off or maybe she needs a couple of days off. And we're able to more carefully observe her behavior because of taking that step. So that's just one example. And then the next step would be antecedent arrangement. And I think we all do this with training all species, but with reptiles and ectotherms, it's particularly important because we need to be conscious of their ecological needs. So if we sort of have to balance what we're asking them to leave with what we're asking them to come to, because it's not just food and water and tactile that are reinforcers. We have such a larger bank of reinforcers with them, from humidity to misting to all different types of water presentation to heat and shade and shelter. And so sort of looking at that space in a very real way and seeing how are we going to allow this animal to say yes? How are we going to allow them to say no? Where in their habitat are we going to realize that maybe they're not interested in training today? How are we going to decide how often we're going to train? I work with some animals that I train maybe once a week or once every 10 days. And that's not even because I'm using food reinforcers. It's because that's where that animal is at. And I start to see stress signals if we are interacting with them more than that. So we're dealing with animals that are very good conservationists in that they're used to sort of preserving their energy. And if you're training too frequently, you can actually cause them extra stress. And so giving them, how are we going to arrange the space to make sure that they truly have a choice? And one of the big things to look at that, especially with young animals or animals that have not done a lot of training, is there adequate flight distance in the habitat? Because a lot of these animals are prey animals, even a lot of these snakes, can that animal get far enough away from you to where they feel comfortable? And if not, how are you going to address that? Maybe it's by opening the door and taking a step back and allowing them to come to you. But you have to sort of find ways to work with the space that you have or to change the space. And I know as zookeepers, we don't always have the option right away of changing the space. And so kind of looking at creatively, how am I going to work with this? How am I going to get this animal to a place where they feel safe and comfortable so that I can actually start training? And then the next step would just be filling that trust bank like we would do with any species, I think. So offering different reinforcers to find preferred ones, create simple if-then contingencies. So if I do this, then this happens, so that there starts to be some consistency to how you're interacting with them, so they can predict what's going to happen next. Start to offer enrichment opportunities. So again, going back to the first step, when you're taking data and you're seeing how they're using that entire space, thinking about how you can introduce enrichment items to help them to use the space more completely, to help them go through their entire natural behavior repertoire. Offering access can be a wonderful way to build trust and to build confidence in the animal. I personally use a lot of puzzle feeders. I find that it helps the snakes to spend more time in the feeding process and get out more natural behavior. And then start allowing the snake to say no. So by altering your behavior in response to theirs. So I think a lot of times, especially with reptiles, we don't train them as frequently. So when we decide, oh, it's time to train the snake, we go to the habitat. And they may say they have no interest in training that day, but sometimes we want to push it because, well, I only have so much time and this is the time I've allotted. And with ectotherms, because they move through their heat gradients differently, they digest differently, the motivations are just different. And sort of learning how to interpret that body language and make sure that we're listening to, again, make sure that trust bank is getting more and more full. And then as you sort of build that foundation, you can then raise the criteria, which would be step four, and making a plan for learning, that's going to be airless, making choices very easy, utilizing highest reinforcers for new behaviors and those requiring the most trust. Sometimes these reinforcers are not food. Oftentimes they're not food, especially with snakes, but with different ectotherms, you have different things available. But oftentimes it's looking at, too, is this an animal that's more active in the PM or the AM? And can I interact with them when they're already active, when they're already offering behavior and sort of catch that behavior? And then throughout that, kind of stopping and reassessing, am I progressing? Is the snake displaying any, or other ectotherm, displaying any signs of stress? And if not, what can I change to make them more comfortable and more likely to want to offer behavior? Listening to them throughout. And then I guess, as I said before, just making sure that you're not overtraining, because they do operate a bit differently than mammals and birds. So I guess that was a quick one through. So hopefully I didn't talk too fast.
No, it was great. And to recap, and I might have got the label for the last one incorrect, the last of the four steps. But number one is collect your data. Number two is antecedent arrangement. Number three is filling that trust bank. Number four was, if I get this one wrong, was it make a plan?
You could say that. I say raising criteria, because you're I sort of look at it that the whole time that you're interacting with your animal, whether you're feeding or cleaning, you're training them. Whether you're looking at it as training or not, it's sort of I guess you could say passive training. And so when we get to step four, it's sort of raising your criteria and the animal's criteria, and I guess making it into a more formal plan of how you're going to accomplish what you're looking to accomplish. But yeah, you could say make a plan as well.
And so in that first step, collecting data, you talked about understanding snake body language and understanding signs of stress. Where can people go to learn more about learning about snake body language and or ectotherm body language?
I have mostly learned through working with the snakes themselves. So I don't know that there's a proper link right now, but I can certainly put up some of that information on the Reptelligence site or send you some to link to this page as well. But it's going to change also depending on your animal. So some snakes, like I mentioned with Jula, that Jumerals, she was very subtle with her changes in behavior. And you could have possibly even interpreted, you know, her utilizing those boxes as a positive thing. But through sort of watching her, you learn that to interpret it in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, through observation, which is the first step, right?
Yeah. So there are many different signs of stress. The most common is probably the tensing or tightening of the body for the snake. But hyperactivity can also be. So sometimes when we introduce enrichment or training, we find a snake is very, very active. Well, activity can be good, but it can also be a sign of stress. So perhaps what would be best is, I'll put together some of these signs and link them to the page. Does that work? Or do you want to spend more time on this?
That'd be amazing.
No.
No, I think that works, and people that are interested in that specific side of things, which should hopefully be everyone that's working with these species, can go to the page and get that further information. With regards to antecedent arrangement, you said setting up yes, no options, so the snake can say yes or no.
Right.
Now, this is clouded in the fog. I'm going to take a guess for a significant amount of people who work with reptiles, and hopefully my way of describing things resonates with people. What advice can we give to keepers specifically who have to take these ideas to their managers who might be surrounded by fog? What are some suggestions about how to start to inject these ideas into organizations?
Well, I think probably the greatest motivator for keepers who do need to go to management is to look at this as an opportunity to increase visitor interaction with the animals and increase guest experience. So if visitors are taking away more from watching that animal, whether in habitat or out of habitat, then I think that there's a way to find shared value with management in that regard. But as far as changing spaces, I have found that to be not the easiest to get around. And so a lot of times it's more being creative with what you have until you can show maybe the smallest advancement to management and sort of start to build that rapport and get that support that you need to continue building on the foundation. So, you're sort of training snakes and sort of dealing with the politics at the same time.
And you can head to the Reptelligence Facebook page and say, sure, head over to Animal Training Academy and engage in either of those spaces too and get support and ideas there. One idea you shared, Carrie, was providing the snakes, and I don't know if you talked about it within step two or step three, but providing the snakes with puzzle feeding opportunities. Can you give some examples of these?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the first things I started doing with one of the Reptelligence snakes. She was 4 months old when I got her. She is a Australian Wilma python. And her very first, from day one when I started feeding her, she was fed through different puzzle feeders. And so they started out as just sort of laundry detergent caps with some holes drilled on the bottom so that she could flip it and get to the food. So it started out quite simple. Then we moved to boxes where she could go into the box and find the food. We worked with mazes, quite simple mazes, maybe two or three or four turns. And then I also use a lot of dog enrichment devices, but you have to be a bit careful and look for ways that the animal may interact with it different than a mammal would. So, and I tend to post my mistakes as well as my successes when it comes to reptiligence. But there's sometimes where reptiles or ectotherms were sort of key in on where the scent is coming from and try to go through the smallest of holes to get to it, rather than maybe lifting a flap or turning something as it's designed. With her, she was able to actually get to the point of doing a device where she both had to slide a device one way and then slide a device another way to get to her food. I've also done some where I give her different boxes that look exactly the same with a lid that she has to turn. And I don't mean to screw it off like maybe some of the octopus enrichment that we've seen, but it's simply sitting on the top and it's pinned with one nail. So she just has to slide it around, but it just keeps her from being able to accidentally knock the lid off. But with these different puzzles, what I have found is that she can actually spend up to over 2 hours working on a specific puzzle. And to me, I'm starting to see some patterns. I don't have enough data to really make a claim yet, but I know that seeking patterns and foraging patterns and time budgets are quite heavily studied in mammals and birds. And I would make the hypothesis that these same type of, well, not the same time type, but that foraging patterns also exist with reptiles. And so when they're able to go through their entire sequence of hunting, so sort of sensing, finding where it is, figuring out how they're going to get to it, and then actually striking and grabbing that food, that if that process takes more of a natural amount of time as it would in their native habitat, I find that it actually reduces some of the negative behaviors that we don't like to see in captive animals, like pacing the glass or maybe jumping out at us when the glass opens because of anticipating food. And I find they're quite calm. So with this particular snake, I can actually sit with her on the ground and she can work on her puzzle, and then she'll sort of take a break and lay down, or she'll crawl up over my lap and then go and take another break, and then she'll go and interact with the puzzle again. So there seems to be some sort of pattern in that she gives herself so long of really hard interaction, and then she sort of takes a rest and thinks about it again and then goes at it again. And I can't say, you know, what she's thinking. I wish I could, but I don't have that data. But there does seem to be this ability to stay with a particular thing for quite a long time. And I wonder how engaging that in these different reptiles might change the behavior that we see in captive reptiles in general.
And building on that, what's the importance of this? Can you share with the listeners of this podcast why you think this is important?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons I think it's important. One of them being that I think that reptiles don't always get the best rap in general, and they're harder to connect with for a lot of people. And so by being able to connect with them more and see them doing more, I think that we can build some, maybe some bridges to where we can be more empathetic towards them in general. So especially when using different dog toys, when I'm posting that to maybe not just reptile people, but to, or people that really love reptiles, but to people in general, and they see a snake able to solve this puzzle that maybe they've given their dog, they look at the reptiles quite differently than they did initially. So they say, well, I still feel a bit iffy about snakes, but that's really interesting, and that's really exciting that they're able to do that, and I can appreciate that. And I think that that's just important in general for how culturally we feel about reptiles, at least here in the States. But also it provides opportunities for these animals to practice their full behavior repertoire. And when you're keeping an animal in a small box with just a water bowl and paper, I don't know that we're allowing for that full behavior sequence. And yes, they may survive, but I don't know that they're thriving or they're showing us what they're fully capable of. And that, I think, also affects our perceptions of them. So if there's, when they're not offered any opportunities and they don't do anything, then we look at them maybe as not as intelligent of an animal. But if they are given these opportunities, I think as keepers, we could develop a closer bond with them as well and understand them more as an individual. And that affects their overall care and well-being. And we're able to give them more choice and control because we can actually communicate in a way. But then I think too, just looking at reptiles in the overall picture, we don't know enough about them. And biodiversity is so important, and we're learning so much about these species, and we're losing so many species every day. But we still have so much to learn about ourselves and about other species from looking at reptiles. And I think it sort of pulls the lens in on them and makes them look less disposable and less unimportant to overall. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yeah, no, you definitely have. And we're going to talk about this in the next question anyway, so I'll kind of just skip forward and we're going to go backwards again soon. And we talked about a lot there about the importance cognitively of providing this enrichment for these animals, and I'm sure everyone that's listening to this podcast agrees with all the things that you've just said. You've also talked about in your presentation just the importance of giving these animals that physical exercise and giving them the ability to exercise.
Absolutely. And I don't think, honestly, that we know the extent to which, you know, keeping these animals more sedentary is really affecting them physically or affecting their offspring physically. And I don't know that we will see those physical changes until further down the road. And hopefully, you know, before it makes some sort of, you know, permanent difference on these species, because some of these species are only kept in human care at this point because of the status of wild environments. And I don't know that there's been, you know, studies of how this affects the heart or the lungs or the muscular structure. And a lot of times we do have, especially as zookeepers, this challenge of keeping these animals in smaller spaces than they would be in their native habitat. I mean, looking at just a few snake species that I was able to find some data on, they're traveling at least maybe a mile or two from their den, but at the most, maybe 25 miles from their den throughout a week or a month. And so taking an animal that travels that much and saying, oh, you're fine in a box, well, they might be, but we don't know what effect that's having. And I know that there are some studies coming out, hopefully in the next couple of years, I've heard bits and pieces of studying cortisol levels in reptiles, focusing on, I think, snakes and another species as well, another taxa. And I think that information will be quite helpful as well to see how it's impacting their stress levels and how that might be internalized to their physical body.
Yeah, it's exciting.
So I'm quite excited.
Me too. Looking forward to that. Just thank you for all that, Carrie. Just to go back a little bit, one of the behaviors that you discussed in your presentation that you gave at CCC in Sweden was crate training.
Yes.
Can you describe for people the process of crate training a snake and how you utilize it?
Yeah, so we sort of ended up back chaining a little bit. So we had started training these snakes to come out of their habitat largely on their own. Some of them, it's still a work in progress, but we had gotten to the point where they're, you know, choosing to stay on this branch or choosing to stay on the tree, the snake tree. And the snake tree actually became quite reinforcing to where some snakes did not want to get off of the snake tree. Well, we didn't want to make that aversive to where we're telling them when they have to leave. And so they already had the choice to go up high to where they could not interact with guests if they wanted to. And we frequently put different reinforcers on the platform. So different scents or heat options, that type of thing. And we just found that some of them just did not want to leave because they would just continue to go up and down and around and move around. And they're not expressing any stress signals to where we're worried that they are not happy. And so what we sort of devised is, well, we'll have to train them to come down when they would like to, and then sort of shape it to where the crate is becoming more and more reinforcing. So what we did is actually, at this point, we're still using non-food reinforcers because using food in that setting at this point, I don't feel would be the most appropriate because we are surrounded by guests and we sort of have to find a way to make that a more controlled stimulus. But so we simply experimented with providing different things in the crate that different snakes find reinforcing. So perhaps Jello, the corn snake, would want to only go into a crate with some leaves in it, so she can sort of move around in the loose leaves. Or one of the pythons may only want to go in where there's a soft, fuzzy blanket or something very comforting that they can get under and feel very contained and sort of comfort in there. Or maybe they want a heat source in there. And so it sort of was a trial and error to see which snakes wanted what. And we sort of alternate between natural substrates and I guess you'd say non-natural substrates, and using those to sort of encourage them. And what we found is that they would start to utilize, they would start to tell us when they were ready to be done. So they actually start to go down the tree rather than up. And then we were able to provide the crate and they would simply go in. And then we were able to uncrate them the same way by simply opening the crate and allowing them access to their habitat. And so it became a very nice solution to sort of getting them off of the snake tree versus having to make that choice for them. They were then given that choice and control. And sometimes maybe they're having an off day and they don't want to be on there at all, and they can communicate that as well. And we can provide the crate and then they can feel safe and secure. And so, it just became quite a nice solution.
I like overall. It. I think we could do a whole podcast just on crate training, but we will move on. One thing you said in your presentation and I thought had value to just add in the end here is that learning's happening anyway. We can't get past that. We're interacting with the snakes, they're interacting with us, we're interacting with their environment, they're interacting with their environment. Learning's happening. So basically what you're suggesting is that we have these discussions, we think about this more, we be creative, and we just leverage what's already happening anyway.
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, if we're looking at snakes through kind of the same, or any reptile, lizards, tortoises, invertebrates, all of it, if we're looking at it through the same lens as we're looking at mammals and birds and all living things, and we're using sort of that Skinner box and those quadrants, then we know that learning is taking place. And I think if we're honest, a lot of keepers and even hobbyists and pet owners and breeders, we can all sort of see that what we do does have an effect on what these animals are doing. We can see that in their behavior. But I think a lot of times we sort of put these labels instead of, oh, this snake is aggressive, or that snake is grumpy, or that turtle is stubborn or shy, or whatever the case may be. But regardless, we are interacting with them, and so they are learning about us. They're learning about their environment. They're learning what works for them, what doesn't work for them. And when we're looking to try to change something too, I think it's important to realize that we're asking that animal, as with any other animal, to change something that's working for them. So one example that I would often give my dog training students is, if you want to sort of think about how hard it is for your dog to stop doing this particular thing, maybe just move your kitchen trash can across the room for a week or a month and see how many times you go to where you would normally put the trash, because that'll give you an idea, you know, how easy it is to sort of form these habits and these behaviors that work for us, and how when we're trying to change that behavior, we have to really stop and think about what we're doing, and the animal does as well, and sort of giving that freedom, I guess I would say, to have that safe space to learn, I think is paramount.
I like it. Sadly, no. That does nearly bring us to the end, but we're heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show. And also before we do, thank you very much for all of that, Carrie. That was amazing. We're heading into story time now, though. Carrie, can you please share with everyone listening two or three stories from your experience training reptiles, training snakes, training any animal so far, and some of the important lessons that you've learned along the way?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I suppose I can start with one lizard story. Probably pretty close to the beginning of when I first started training reptiles. I was working with a young Euromastix, which is a spiny-tailed lizard. It's a kind of a smaller, very similar to Nick Gallman family. It's very similar to maybe a bearded dragon or a chuckwalla, but they're a bit different. And I was training her to get on the scale. And so we had frequently used this very same reinforcer that she loved, these sweet peas. And I decided that I was going to go and get a whole bunch of other wonderful new reinforcers. And so I had berries and bee pollen and all of these things. And so we're having quite a good session. And I'm thinking, I will give her a better reward than she is used to. I'll give her, you know, this piece of what I think it was a berry. And so she got it. she looked at it and she realized it was not a sweet pea. And she tail whipped and turned around and ran down under her hide and sat there for quite a few seconds, came back up, jumped on the edge of the habitat, looked at me, went back under her hide and sort of just stayed there and wiggled her tail every so often, just shaking it. And so I was like, well, what have I just seen? Because, you know, even at this point, I'm still not, I'm operating under the assumption that obviously animals can be trained, but I was not expecting, you know, probably that degree of emotion. So I immediately got on, you know, and emailed a bunch of colleagues. And I think I even emailed Dr. Susan Friedman and I said, what have I just seen? And of course, they all say, well, you need more data. And that's exactly true. But I did learn quite a bit from that, in that these if then contingencies are so important. And when you sort of change it, even if you think you're doing it for the better, sometimes it's not for the better for that animal. And so you have to really sort of pick what you're doing based on that data that you have, and don't sort of try to change it in the middle, because it can kind of throw you off. let me see. And then I do have a story from when I was dog trainer. I was asked to help with this situation where these animals had been abandoned on a property, and the owner was experiencing quite a bit of trouble. And so a colleague invited me out to help, saying, well, can you come just assess these animals and help us out? Well, it turned into be quite more involved. But at a certain point, we'd caught all but one or two dogs and this puppy. And this one dog that we hadn't caught was quite aggressive. And so I was working with quite a new friend of mine, and she was a strict vegetarian. And I was bringing out these piles of raw meat, and we were using a system of positive reinforcement as well as using moving away as a reinforcer. So I was asking her to approach this dog, throw this food, this raw meat, which she was quite disgusted by, and then walk away. And so I think I'm always quite impressed with the level of trust that people put in us as trainers, and really sort of humbled by that, and motivated by that to do the very best that I can, and take on that responsibility with a proper somberness and not disrespect that. And so, I mean, she was willing to do these things, and it worked. And then to see the benefits of that, and to be able to get that dog on a leash and out to rescue and into a new home, it was quite rewarding. But to do so, I mean, I was really quite reliant on that trust. And so it's not just animals we build trust with, it's also people. And I think we just need to remember to respect that trust, whether it's with an animal or with a person.
I like it. So the importance of if-then contingencies, and we've talked about building trust with our ectotherms and snakes and reptiles today, but we've also got to remember to do that with each other.
Yes, absolutely.
You, of course, did not disappoint with those wonderful stories. Sadly, it does bring us to our final question for this episode. Carrie, could you please take us all into the future and share with us what you would really like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training, snake training, ectotherm training world?
Oh, yes. I wish it could happen in the next year. But I hope that we continue to learn more about these magnificent animals, that we incorporate this into our husbandry. I think we may see reptile husbandry as it exists change to be quite different. So I hope that we will. I hope that we will start to be able to encourage natural behavior more in a captive environment, not just for educational purposes with others, but also in the relationships that we have with these animals, and also just for their overall well-being, that we engage them in ways that really give them this full life as they would have in their native habitat. I hope that we, through that, can inspire a love and an empathy for ectotherms that maybe we all don't have at this point, but I know that we don't all have at this point. And through that, we can preserve some of these native spaces where these animals live. And I hope that just in general, the perception about reptiles changes, in that we can start to see that if they are capable of preferences, if they're capable of making choices, that they're capable of behavior, that they're capable of operant conditioning. And if they're capable of behavior, that there has to be an element of emotion tied to those behaviors. And it's really up to us as caretakers to recognize that and address those emotions as well as part of the whole animal. So I think I would like to see the spaces and the husbandry change, which is something that we talk about quite a bit in the group attached to Reptelligence, is how can we make our spaces inviting and safe for the animals, so that it encourages training and that it encourages behavior and makes it a safe space where we can communicate back and forth. I would like to see our knowledge grow so that we understand that I, you know, had a colleague that was a neuroscientist, or someone that has some interest in actually studying the reptile brain and how they are processing this, because I think that's one of the big hiccups when we come to sort of butt heads between traditional management is, well, reptiles don't have this part of the brain that would allow them to do this. And so I think if we can study that and see how they are making these decisions, what's motivating that, what's driving their behavior, how are they processing? I mean, barely have the tip of that even when it comes to mammals and birds. But if we can start to see that the brain is capable of this, I think that would move us forward quite a bit faster. And then just, I would love to see the citizen science of just everyone who has an interest in this, just jump in and do it. And please take data and share your data, because if we aren't sharing with each other, it's going to take us even longer to get ahead. And don't just share successes, share failures as well. I think that's so important, and something that so often we're leery to do because it's not really a safe space to do that. But when we share our failures, we can move together so much faster. We can move forward together. And so I would just like to see all of that in the next year, if possible. That would be great. No, in the next 10 years, I suppose.
And Reptelligence is a safe place to go discuss this stuff. Animal Training Academy is for people that want to take you up on this challenge. Where can they go out? Or where can they go, I should say, sorry. Where can they go to find out more about Reptelligence and what you're doing? Can you provide us the links verbally? Or?
Yeah. So if you go to Facebook/Reptelligence, you can find the page there. You can certainly click and follow that. In addition to that page, there is attached to that page a group where we discuss training in particular. People post different training and enrichment that they're doing. You're quite able to get feedback. It's very closely monitored, so it's a very safe space to do that. And everyone is sort of a similar mind, in that we are all wanting to see each other succeed. So it's very, very safe place to do that. In the future, hopefully, we will expand web presence a bit more. But for now, that's probably the best way.
Fantastic. And we will link to all of this in the podcast write-up as well. So if you're unsure, head over to animaltrainingacademy.com and check out the podcast section, find Carrie's episode, and it'll all be included in there for you, nice and simple. Hey, thank you so much for sharing everything today, Carrie. And so before we do officially wrap up, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. It's mega appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was an honor, and it was great to, you know, be able to discuss some of these topics. I think it's every time that I get to discuss it with someone else who shares a similar interest, it just builds so much more motivation and excitement in me to continue to move forward. And I think probably maybe the best information and research and training is yet to come, and probably from others who are smarter and more intelligent than I am, but I'm excited to be part of this process and to see it happening. And yeah, I'm just thrilled. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I hope that we lived up to, and I know we don't like to use labels, but I hope that we lived up to the behavior nerd label that we said at the start of the episode.
I think so.
We do, of course, appreciate you tuning in today and hanging out with us. If you have enjoyed the episode and you are interested in carrying on these conversations about most positive, less intrusive ways of influencing behavior, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the ATA, the Animal Training Academy community, is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with like-minded, positive reinforcement-based animal trainers from around the globe. With you train or are thinking about training dogs, cats, birds, pets, zoo animals, vet clinics, zoos, kennels, wherever behavior management is required, you will love all the different ways you can join in. Forums, WhatsApp chats, private Facebook group, live web classes, there's something there for absolutely everyone, and we are looking forward to having you join the family. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening, everyone, but for now, you'll hear from us again soon. Toodaloo.